Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. When you're young and you're trying to figure out your life, you don't usually know what you're good at, right? These kind of things take time. And not everyone finds their calling in life the way that, say, Kamasi Washington did. He is an acclaimed jazz composer, band leader, and he also plays the saxophone beautifully.
I never thought that I could make music like the music that I liked because I hadn't found my voice. And it was like when I found the saxophone, like it was almost immediate, like it was like I could see it. It was like all of a sudden, like, oh, we're there right there. That's where you will be able to make music that you like enjoy. And I was like, oh, wow, I could do that? Like I could make a song that make me feel the way I feel when I hear this Art Blakey record. I could do that? Like, oh, wow. And then I was just hooked, you know, all that addictive personality, like 97% of it went right into the saxophone and music.
It's Bullseye. This week, Kamasi Washington, one of the most talented jazz musicians alive today. But the saxophone wasn't always his instrument of choice.
Yeah, I remember in school, like, everybody had the recorders, and I had a clarinet, and that was just really, really cool, because, you know, it was so much cooler than the recorder. Probably the coolest a clarinet has ever been is when I brought my clarinet to school for music day, and everybody else had recorders.
Plus, Kamasi tells me about the thrill he gets from being really good at Street Fighter II. So good, in fact, that he wrote his own walk-up music for the arcade game.
Yeah, when I walk into the arcade, they should play that and strike fear in all the nerds.
Finally, a special treat, a short story from the brilliant comedy writer Simon Rich. That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest this week is Kamasi Washington. He plays the saxophone. He also does a lot of production work. He's collaborated with Thundercat, Ryan Adams, Flying Lotus, Run the Jewels. That's only a few. You can hear his work on the classic Kendrick Lamar album To Pimp a Butterfly as well. Do you believe in me? Are you deceiving me? Could I let you down easily? It's your heart where it need to be. It's your smile on permanent. It's your foul on lifetime. What you know where the sermon is. If I died in this next line. If I'm trying to... But to define Kamasi Washington by the people he's collaborated with is to do him a disservice. He's a dynamic, thrilling composer and bandleader. Between 2005 and now, he's recorded about half a dozen solo records, and they are brilliant. If you fell in love with the work of Alice Coltrane or Pharoah Sanders, you'll hear something familiar in Kamasi's music. Like them, Kamasi writes songs from a transcendent, almost spiritual place. It's strange and lush, hypnotizing melodies. The songs run long. But just like the free jazz greats before him, you end up losing yourself. But Washington isn't a product of the late 60s. He grew up in the 80s. He was raised here in Los Angeles, where we make Bullseye. And he grew up listening to jazz music, but also N.W.A. and Marvin Gaye and Snoop Dogg. So the music he makes is eclectic, but effortlessly so. It's why his albums have ended up on so many critics' top 10 lists, and it's also why those same critics have written thousands of words asking the same question: can Kamasi Washington make jazz a young person's game again? It's kind of a weird position to be in, to be called the savior of the kind of music that you live and breathe. He doesn't think about it much. Instead, he keeps putting out new music, working on new collaborations. His latest record is called Heaven and Earth. Let's listen to a track off it. It's called Street Fighter Moss.
Yeah.
Kamasi Washington, welcome to Bullseye. I'm so happy to have you on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Is that really a song that you wrote for yourself to be your own theme music when you're playing Street Fighter?
Yeah, when I walk into the arcade, I should play that and strike fear in all the nerds.
I mean, at this point in your career, you could probably afford to have a guy roll with you. And if you just have that guy carry a tape deck.
Yeah, with a boom box.
Yeah. Fighting games are interesting to me because the amount of focus it takes to execute the often really complicated
things that are required.
Yeah, that's what made me think of it. Like, it is kind of weirdly like learning an instrument.
You have to practice, and you have to, like, stay on it, too. Like, if you stop playing for a little while, you kind of lose your stuff. It's intense. It's intense. And, like, it's one of those – it's very addictive. So I always warn people, like, it's fun. But if you have a competitive spirit kind of in it, like, if you're able to take things that aren't that serious and be serious about them, which is, you know, I think that's like the personality type that gets into fighting games, like, because it's not really a serious thing, but like, it will ruin your day. Like, someone, like, you get a bad beat, like a bad loss, and it would like affect you. Like, you'd be sitting there eating dinner hours later, you're like, I just knew. He was going to jump. That's why I did the dragon punch, because he was going to jump. I feel like he did jump. You know.
I think in the video you're playing regular Street Fighter 2, like on an arcade console. Is that your Street Fighter? Because there's a bunch of them.
I play most of the Street Fighters from Street Fighter 2 up until now. Right now I'm playing Street Fighter 5.
Do you have a favorite character in Street Fighter to play?
Ryu has definitely been my like classic character throughout all the different games, like, you know, since Street Fighter 2.
I like the stretchy arms guy. That's my favorite.
Oh, Dawson? Yeah. I mean, in Street Fighter 5, I use Blanca as well, and I use Guile. Ryu got a little bit nerfed in this game, but I still use Ryu. I think he's still a good character. I use a character called Falk as well.
Have you ever been to one of these tournaments where somebody like rents a warehouse and people drive up trucks full of Street Fighter 2 consoles and like load them into the warehouse?
Yeah, I mean I've been to Evo a few times, and you know, for a minute, I mean, I have a few friends that are like professional Street Fighter players, so I would go to like bar fights, just like a fighting game tournament at a bar. I've been to quite a few tournaments. I mean, like I said, if you're able to get beyond the fact that like we are taking this much too seriously, you know, and just embrace it and be more serious about this and talk about it in more detail than you probably should, and talk about frame data and you know, and all those other things that we get into. It's fun.
You know, I read an interview with your dad, who is also a musician, where he described that you were capable, even as a kid, of sitting down and playing piano for hours. You were the person in your family or in your generation of the family who, when you sat down at the piano, you stayed at the piano. That's a little bit like that kind of focus that you need to play Street Fighter for hours.
Yeah, I definitely have an addictive personality. So, like, and I have, like, a long attention span. So, like, I don't get bored easily. You know, I can do anything that I'm enjoying doing, I can do it for a long time, you know? So, yeah. I mean, I remember being a kid. I mean, I could sit around and, like, I could also just sit around and daydream for a long time and just literally, like, stare out the window and have a whole little scene and movie play out in my head. I don't know. It's just, it's part of, you know. And so when I really got into music, it definitely was a benefit. Because it was like, you know, where it was like some kids had a hard time practicing. It was like once I started practicing, I had a hard time stopping. You know, it was like once I got going, I didn't want to stop.
I imagine that it was your father who first put an instrument in your hand. Is that true?
Yeah.
Did you like it? I mean, were you too young to know the difference between liking it and not liking it?
Yeah, I mean, my first instrument was drums, and I was probably like 3. So I don't really – I mean, I remember getting the drum set because I got it for my birthday. And but it's hard for me to remember not having it. You know what I mean? I remember getting it, but trying to remember life before it, before music, it's kind of hard for me to, you know, it's super fuzzy.
Did you always want to do it in a serious way, or was there a period? I mean, like, there were things my dad wanted me to do, and I did not do any of them.
No, I wasn't really serious about it at first. You know, I had an older brother that was really kind of like a child prodigy, so it was kind of his thing. You know, but I always liked music, but I wasn't like serious about it. You know, so you know, I didn't really get serious about music until I started playing saxophone. You know, before that, you know, I liked music. I liked playing it. You know, I liked playing the instruments. It was fun. And I did it very much recreationally. You know, I remember in school, like, everybody had the recorders. And I had a clarinet. And that was just really, really cool because, you know, it was so much cooler than the recorder. Probably the coolest a clarinet has ever been is when I brought my clarinet to school for music day and everybody else had recorders.
I was about to say, I think this is the first time since like 1967 that someone has announced how cool their clarinet is.
Oh, it was the coolest thing to all the other kids. You know, if you don't have an instrument, and I, you know, because my dad had been giving me lessons, so like I could play. I remember I knew a lot of the Boys to Men songs on the clarinet, and like I knew some Jodeci songs, and I could play like some of the hooks from like N.W.A. I just knew radio songs on the clarinet, and it was a clarinet. It was like wood, and I could play in any key. And the recorder was like limited. It was very much like an electric guitar compared to those recorders. You know, it was pretty rock star.
Did you have a signature tune? I mean, was it like "Wait Until You Hear My Lay Your Head on My Pillow"?
What was it? No. It wasn't "Lay Your Head on Your Pillow." It was "If I Ever Fall in Love." You know, I'm not going to sing it right now because, you know, evidence of me singing that song. It's not necessarily move, but yeah, that was like the song. Yeah.
What happened when you started playing saxophone when you were 12?
Well, a year and a half, 2 years before that, I got into jazz. And
when you were like 10?
10 or 11, around in there somewhere.
I think that might be unusual, even in a household where your dad is a professional jazz musician.
My dad had been trying to get me into jazz. It felt late to him. You know, he was like showing me Ascensions and Ohm and stuff like that when I was like five. So I'm sure to him it was like, it felt like, finally, jeez, you know. But when I got into jazz, you know, I was really into Art Blakey and Jazz Messengers and Wayne Shorter, and you know, I got into like Charlie Parker. I really liked the saxophone. And my dad, since I had been playing clarinet the whole time, he kept telling me that the clarinet and the saxophone were the same thing. And so I was trying to learn those songs on clarinet. And it was like, first off, they were just hard like to do because they're not exactly the same. And it just didn't sound the same. And I was just like, man, it just does not sound the same. He was like, no, it's because you haven't practiced. And I remember like getting the saxophone. He had a saxophone out one day, and I just picked it up. And I figured out how to play this song that I had been playing on clarinet. And all of a sudden, it sounded like, I mean, I'm sure it didn't sound exactly like it, but it sounded like the records I've been listening to. And it was like, before that, you know, I admired great musicians and I liked good music, you know. I never thought that I could make music like the music that I liked because I hadn't found my voice. And it was like when I found the saxophone, like it was almost immediate, like it was like I could see it. It was like all of a sudden, like, oh, we're there right there. That's where you will be able to make music that you like the music that you enjoy. And I was like, oh, wow, I could do that? Like, I could make a song that make me feel the way I feel when I hear this Art Blakey record? I could do that? Like, oh, wow. And then I was just hooked, you know, all that addictive personality. Like, 97% of it went right into the saxophone and music. Yeah.
What were you excited about like Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers when you were 12 or 11?
It was the feel. I don't know. It had this kind of like hard, like kind of exciting feel to it that just resonated with me, you know. And there, you know, there was that Tribe Called Quest song that had the Art Blakey sample on it. My cousin gave me this tape that had all these Art Blakey songs, and that was one of them.
That does feel like a secret when you hear that.
Yeah, you're like, what's that? This is, you know, and then the rest of the song comes in, and you're like, oh, wow. You know, I didn't even know. I don't think I was really fully aware that hip-hop was sampling. At that point, I don't know if I was really fully aware of what that meant, you know?
I mean, I remember how much it blew my mind when I heard People Every Day by Arrested Development.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, I know that song. That's that Sly and the Family Stone song my mom loves. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was definitely like that. And then, you know, it made it cool. You know, it instantly made it cool. I mean, it took it away from my dad and it gave it to me, you know? And so, like, I no longer looked at it like it was his. It was mine. His whole record collection was no longer his. It was mine. You know what I mean? I started, like, you know, I moved the records. And, you know, it was like, you know, it was kind of funny. Like, they were literally, like, in a different place. And I took them outside to where I used to practice and stuff. And I took the whole record player. And, you know, he came out in a panic. Like, somebody stole the record player. Like, no, I just moved it.
When you were a kid, did you think your dad's music career was cool?
My older brother may remember it a little better than me. I was pretty young when my dad made a decision not to tour anymore.
He was a public school teacher.
Yeah, yeah. He wanted to stay home. He didn't want to be out on the road. He wanted to, especially when my parents divorced. So that was when I was about 3. I used to always want my dad to go out and play more. But especially by the time I was playing music, I always knew he was talented, and I was a pretty adventurous kid. So like, by the time I was 13, 14, I was out in the streets, you know, playing in jam sessions, doing gigs and stuff. And my dad had kind of like, by that point, he had been teaching so long and kind of like removed himself from the scene so much that he wasn't playing that much, you know? And so I used to really want him to go out and, like, play. And he was like, I got to go to work in the morning, you know? He's like, you can sleep through class, but I can't, you know? And I was appreciative of the fact that he did make that sacrifice, but I used to always wish that he would get out and play more. So it's been cool for me, like, you know, having him out on the road with us, you know, because it's kind of like, now he is, you know?
Was it difficult for you to have this thing that you were really passionate about that your dad was a professional of?
No, because like I said before, I mean, he wasn't really out. Like, I was out much more. I remember we had a moment actually once where, like, I was really active when I was a kid. You know, I was like, I don't even know how I did all the stuff I was doing. And I ended up having a gig one of my dad's friends. And so my dad's friend calls the house, and this was like before he even had cell phones, so he calls the house. My dad answers, and they're just kind of chopping it up. And he's like, yeah, so is Kamasi there? And he's like, yeah, he's here. He's like, oh, can I talk to him real quick? And he sees me, like, get the phone, and I'm, like, writing down the information for the gig. And he was like, did you just steal my gig? I was like, you gig with you play with him too? I was like, I didn't even know. You know, so I mean, like, he was pretty good about giving me my space musically, you know. He wasn't really like at every gig. I mean, he'd come to the gigs that he thought that I felt like were important for me to be, him to be at, but like, you know, I mean, a lot of times I had to figure out how to get there and get home. Like, it wasn't, I mean, I benefited from the fact of I have like 6 brothers and sisters, so it wasn't like all eyes on me. And I was like, I probably had the least problems of all my siblings, you know? So it was like my parents kind of looked at me like, Kamasi's kind of all right. I don't know, dude. I mean, what am I going to do with this dude right here, you know? So, you know, I kind of had both, you know, like if I needed some help with music, I could always go ask my dad, like, you know. But even, like, it was weird because it was, like, I had other friends that had, like, private lessons. And it was, like, a really, like, regimented thing. Like, on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I go to this guy and he tells me what to do. My dad didn't really tell me what to do. You know, he just, like, here's a whole stack of books, music books, that have everything you need to know about music. Here's a whole big old record collection. Here's any instrument you really want to play. Have at it, you know? And it's just like anything that I didn't understand, like, hey, I don't understand what a, you know, half diminished, what's between a half diminished and a fully diminished. This is the difference between half diminished and fully diminished. Oh, okay. You know, what's a sharp 11 mean? This is what that means, you know? So it was kind of like it felt like a very natural relationship with it, you know? So I didn't have that sense of someone driving me, you know?
Even more with Kamasi Washington. Stay with us. When we come back from a break, we'll talk about one of his first paying gigs, playing in the band of one Snoop Doggy Dogg. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for NPR and the following message come from ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology finds the right people for you and actively invites them to apply. That's why ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. based on hiring sites with over 1,000 reviews on Trustpilot. And right now, listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/bullseye.
The midterm elections are only a few weeks away.
Yeah, and in the run-up, we here on the NPR Politics Podcast will be there to talk about the major themes, issues, and races.
And of course, every time there's a new headline, we run into the studio to explain it.
The NPR Politics Podcast.
I'm Riley Smurl.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And I'm Taylor Smurl.
And together, we host a podcast called Still Buffering, where we answer questions like,
why should I not fall asleep first at a slumber party?
How do I be fleet?
Is it okay to break up with someone using emojis?
And sometimes we talk about butts.
No, we don't. Nope.
Find out the answers to these important questions and many more on Still Buffering, a sister's guide to teens through the ages.
I am a teenager.
And I was too. Butts, 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 butts.
No. Will you change your mind?
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Kamasi Washington. He's a saxophonist and composer who's worked with Kendrick Lamar, Snoop Dogg, Flying Lotus, and more. His latest album is called Heaven and Earth. It's out now. Here's another song off his new record. This one is called Fists of Fury. Your adolescence was in the early and mid-90s, and you grew up in South L.A. Did you have to make a choice at some point in your life that you are going to be the kind of guy that plays music and plays video games and not have a street life?
Yeah. It happened pretty early for me. I don't think people realize that sometimes, like that identity that, like, you're a gangster when you grow up in that neighborhood. It attaches itself to you really young. Way young, way before you ever do anything that a gangster would do. I was fortunate, and it was weird because I had two great parents, college-educated parents, and, like, I had no real reason to fall into that, you know, other than just my self-image from the outside was pushing me into something that I didn't really have on the inside. And I had these guys that came to my school, and they really taught us about the true nature of our history and where we come from and who we are and, like, what my true potential is. And kind of just showed me, you know, you think you want to be this, but this is what this really is. Do you want to be that or do you want to be this? And, like, when you give someone that choice, it kind of immediately shifts you. And right around that same time, I found music. And music, like, when I found my love for music, it's like, it really is like falling in love with a person, you know? It's like, you don't want to do, you know, I don't want to do anything else, you know? So it was like, it wasn't a hard decision, like, oh, man, I really want to be in the streets, but I should be a good person. And it was like, all I really want to do, I wake up in the morning thinking about this music. I go to sleep thinking about it, and I'm thinking about it all day long. Like, I'm so preoccupied with this, I can't even really, like, what do you want to go to? You want to go spray paint up some walls? It's like, I'm good, man. Like, you know, I'm going to fight somebody? Nah, I'm cool, man. You know, it encompassed me, and it was, so I was fortunate in that sense that it caught me right at that crossroads where a lot of kids get kind of swept into something that they really have had no real intention of being in, you know? Like, it's, you're so young that you don't really even understand what you're getting yourself into until it's too late. And now you're 16, 17, and the world is looking at you like you're an adult, and you're into this thing that you didn't know what you were getting into, you know? And so, like, fortunately for me, when I was, like, 10 or 11, someone came along and swept me out of it. At the same time, I found something that gave me another identity for myself. So it was not a hard thing for me to do.
You were playing in a jazz band, like playing shows when you were a teenager. Did you always imagine a career in jazz?
Jazz was definitely the first music that was my first love in music. But pretty early on, I was always playing, like literally, like, the day that I switched to the saxophone, like, my dad was like, all right, this weekend, we're going to go play at your uncle's church. So, like, I immediately, I mean, it was because of jazz, but I immediately added gospel to the story, you know? And I already had hip-hop kind of was, like, the soundtrack of my generation, my friends, everybody was into that. And then, so I started playing saxophone in eighth grade, and then when I went to ninth grade, I switched schools to, like, I went to Hamilton. It was like a music academy, and so all of a sudden I'm meeting these classical musicians who are, like, really into classical music, and then I developed a love of classical music. So I don't think I was thinking about a career in that sense. I just really liked music. I just wanted to really make really good music, and jazz was probably my favorite of all the music that I was making.
One of your first real jobs as a musician was playing in Snoop Dogg's band. When you got that call, that must have been a mind blower.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Snoop Dogg is Snoop Dogg. No matter, I mean, you could be anyone in America, Snoop Dogg is Snoop Dogg. You know what
I
mean?
Oh, yeah.
Much less to be a guy from L.A.
Oh, yeah. And from South Central L.A., it was like, it was pretty, like, surreal. It was one of those moments where you're like, I definitely didn't expect it, you know. I mean, I've been gigging around the city a lot, you know, as a kid. And Terrace, before that, he did a tour with Kirk Franklin.
It's a gospel superstar. And Terrace Martin, we should say, is both a pretty accomplished jazz musician and a very accomplished hip-hop producer as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, he was definitely, like, he was ahead of the pack in a lot of ways. You know, just, like, I remember, like, when we were kids, he had his own band, like, before us, and it was like, oh, man, like, that. He was, like, always kind of pushing forward, you know? And so he was the first one of us that, like, got, like, an MPC and started, like, producing and, like, making tracks and, like, making the music for hip-hop. Like, we all listened to it, but I hadn't really thought of, like, trying to play hip-hop music, you know? It was like, it existed in a different platform for me. It was like, oh, if I go to a party, you know, I mean, I'm riding around in my car, you know, someone's car, you listen to it. But he was, like, making that music, you know? And I remember he met Battle Cat.
He's a legendary West Coast hip-hop producer who worked extensively with Snoop Dogg.
Yeah, and I remember hearing about that. And he was, you know, so, like, that was a big deal. We were like, dang, you working with Battle Cat? That's dope. And yeah, and then when he called us, he was like, man, Snoop. Because first it wasn't a tour. It was just one gig. He was like, Snoop is doing The Tonight Show, and he wants a horn section. And it was like, oh, snap. And so he went and did it. And I remember Snoop walking off the set and was like, I'm taking the band on tour with me. And we all looked at each other like, I hope that means us as well. Because, you know, the horns are the first ones to get fired. When the budget gets low, we get nervous. And so, yeah, and he did. He, you know, he took us all on the road. And it was, I remember, like, first time, you know, Snoop said, hey, what's up, Kamasi? And I was like, dang, Snoop knows my name. That's crazy. You know, and then, like, you know, we playing Madden and, you know, just hanging out. It was like, wow, this is, you know, someone that I looked up to so much and listened to and idolized when I was a kid, you know, especially like before I played saxophone. I was really, really into like Snoop and Dre. That was like it for me, you know.
You must have learned a lot about creating the aesthetics of hip hop when you were playing in a hip hop band. You can really tell the difference between a band that gets what hip hop is and a band that is just a perfectly good band.
Yeah. Nah, it was a big learning experience for me because, like I said, it was a music that I listened to, but I never really tried to play. And I never really investigated, like, what's a hip hop musician? What does that mean? Like, what does it mean to play this music live, you know, because it was such a, my association was with a DJ, hip-hop was with a DJ. It wasn't like, I didn't associate it with a live band like that. Even though, you know, coming to find out that a lot of that stuff was live musicians replaying stuff, playing over stuff, you know.
Dr. Dre had kind of pioneered the art of bringing in session musicians to replay a record so that he only had to license the rights to the song and not the rights to the recording.
Yeah.
In order to use a sample in a song.
Yeah. And so when we get to that, we get to the first rehearsal, it was one of those things where it was like, I had been studying music so much and so much technically difficult music that I thought that I was going to be fine. And then all of a sudden you get there and it's like their perspective on what it means to play something right is completely different. It's like it's 50-50 what notes you're playing and the other 50% is how you play it. Like literally, like, you could play the right notes and they would look at you like, and I'm like, but that's what you told me to play.
I mean, one of the things about hip-hop beat making is guys who do that and women who do that are obsessed with the qualities of sounds. Yeah. So, like, they're interested, depending on who it is, they may or may not be interested in the kind of traditional musical stuff. You know, sometimes they're well-versed in it, sometimes less so. But the quality of, you know, you could get three hip-hop producers in a room and they would gladly argue for 5 hours about a single snare sound.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, with no problem.
Yeah.
Whereas in most bands, it's like, oh, yeah, as long as there's a hi-hat on the eighth note or whatever it is,
yeah,
then you're doing it right.
Exactly. Like, you're a drummer, and if your snare drum is not tuned right, they'll look at you like you're dropping the beat. Or if you're a bass player and your bass is not super fat, and, like, you know, like, these things are, like, not mildly important, but, like, majorly important. And so at the horn section, it was like the phrasing and your tone quality and, like, the feel of how you play what they wanted you to play was super important, you know? And so it made me kind of think about music differently, you know? And then you had people like, you know, everyone in that band pretty much was a producer. And so all of a sudden, the conversations that you're around, like that, like sounds, you know, records and, like, understanding the importance of a feel, you know, how something feels. I had that subconsciously, but I wasn't consciously ever thinking of it. And all of a sudden, I'm in this scenario where, like, I have to be very conscious of it. Like, what is this feel? Like, where should we place these three notes that they want us to play? That carried over, actually, to how I play jazz. It was like, all of a sudden, now I'm playing 100 notes, but I still feel the need to put that same care that I put on the three notes over these 100 notes, you know? And that's why I started to then hear, like, the trash musicians that I really loved. Like, oh, they're doing that. It doesn't matter how complicated it is. They never lost sight of this other side of the music. You know? And I really learned that from playing with Snoop.
I'm not a musician, but it seems like it would also be a different kind of listening when you're playing, particularly because in jazz music, especially when you're playing relatively casually, one of the things that's happening often is that there's a soloist and there is a band supporting the soloist, and the soloist is doing their thing and often improvisatorily.
Yeah.
What a word. Improvisatorily. And in hip hop, you know, your fealty is towards creating a very sharp, very coherent beat because it's got to move people in a very specific way.
Yeah.
And your soloist is always, I mean, maybe you guys got a solo in the Snoop show, but basically the soloist is always going to be the MC.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it's that, and it's also you're playing records. I mean, with Snoop, you're playing hits. So you're playing records that people love and they know, and like it's a different mentality you have to have of like you have to really, because jazz is so much about self-expression, so much about showing who you are. And this scenario is about creating the sound, you know? It's not about you, you know? And like, and that, that's an important switch to kind of be able to like have to like, okay, I'm going to, yeah, I could play a lot of stuff, but that's not what this needs. And to kind of really just take you out of the equation and really put above everything this, like you said, this thing that is being created by all of us at the same time. This. And Snoop was a part of that. You know, he was the face of it, but he was still a part of it. It was like, it's very much like all these things have to line up and link up perfectly together to make it feel that way. That's going to make everyone feel that way, you know? And so it was, it's just as difficult in its own way. Even though you're only playing three notes, your three notes have to fit perfectly in this thing that has the bass player, the drums, a DJ, a rapper, keyboards, guitars. Everything has to fit in exactly perfectly. And you can't fit in exactly perfectly just by playing the right notes.
We'll finish up my conversation with Kamasi Washington after a quick break. Plus, what if the Grim Reaper had an agent? The answer in short story form when we return. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Our Up First team goes to work while you're sleeping. That way you wake up to the freshest take on the day's news. It's the 10-minute morning news podcast from NPR. Listen to Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, are you looking for a new comedy podcast? In which case, can I draw your attention to the Beef and Dairy Network podcast? It's a fictional industry podcast for the beef and dairy industries. It won Best Comedy at the 2017 British Podcast Awards, and it features wonderful guests such as Greg Davis.
To my knowledge, it's the only cow circus that's ever existed in this country. In rural Russia, every small town has a cow circus.
Josie Long.
You should have a beef. Have a beef with them. I have a beef with you. I will have a beef with you. Come round my house and I'll have a beef with you.
And Andy Daly.
That virus never existed. There was never any such thing as a mad cow disease. That was all an illusion that Big Lamb came up with.
That's the Beef and Dairy Network podcast. Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts from. And I would recommend starting at episode one. Bye.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Kamasi Washington, is a saxophonist and composer. He's collaborated with Kendrick Lamar, Run the Jewels, Flying Lotus, and many others. His newest album is called Heaven and Earth. It's out now. This track is from that album. It's called The Psalmist.
Thank you.
you played on Kendrick Lamar's album To Pimp a Butterfly. And I have to say, like, when I first heard that record, I thought, the thought that I had, it's like, as a big fan of hip hop and a big fan of jazz music, was like, oh, someone finally made it work for real. Like, there's plenty of hip hop records that sample jazz records and essentially transform them into hip hop music that are great. And there's plenty of jazz music that's influenced by hip hop music that's wonderful. And there's plenty of overlap and relationship between the two. But often I feel like that aesthetic disjuncture, that difference between them, is really hard to bridge. And when I heard that record, I was like, oh, this works perfectly.
Yeah.
Like, this is exactly right.
Well, one, I mean, I think that there's a couple of things. I think that, like you said, I mean, hip-hop and jazz have always been kind of intertwined, but it was jazz. It was one, it was intertwined on the level of being a sample, and two, it was meant to be masked to not be jazz. You know, like Dre's putting jazz stuff in there, but it's, he did it in a way that if you didn't know the record, you just wouldn't know that that's what that was. You know what I mean? It's like sometimes you hear those samples and it's like, damn, that's where that comes from. You know what I mean? Kendrick took the approach of putting it in the forefront. Like, I'm not trying to take this jazz and turn it into hip hop or funk. I'm going to leave the jazz right there as that. And I'm not sampling it. I'm going to get musicians to play it and create new music that feels like that, that I'm not, it's not in the background. And that was the big, to me, the major innovation that he did was like, I'm going to take this thing that's usually put in the background and masked to that, to the point where, like, if you don't really know, you won't even know it's there, you know? That's why a lot of people say, oh, it's the first time I've ever heard jazz or hip-hop. It's like, nah, come on, you hear jazz and hip-hop all the time. But it's not meant to feel like jazz. Kendrick is like, I'm going to make it feel like jazz. And he's such an artist that he can make it feel like it fits as well. You know?
And it's kind of a community that you grew up in. I mean, you ended up on, when you ended up on this record, correct me if I'm wrong, but you didn't know Kendrick Lamar before you went in there.
No.
But you knew these guys that you had worked with making jazz records for, at this point, 15 years, maybe more.
Oh, 20 years. Yeah. 20, 25. Yeah, and then we grew up in Lamar Park, like around, you know, Kamal Dudes, you know, the World Stage, and then right around the corner is Project Blow. And so we grew up, you know, really admiring, like, Freestyle Fellowship and, you know, Far Side and all those guys. And they were, like, right around the corner from where we played jazz.
Those are L.A. hip-hop groups that really led the way in innovating the kind of possibilities of the aesthetics of rapping, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and they were totally into it. So it was like Horse Tapscott and Freestyle Fellowship were intertwined, and, you know what I mean? It was like, and for us, for those that were coming underneath them, you know, it was like they were the same thing, you know. And so I think that, you know, and Kendrick coming from that too, you know, he's coming from Compton, but he was, you know, he knew that scene. And, you know, people like Terrace and all those other guys, that whole scene, you know, it kind of did, like you said, it's like it Kendrick took it and put it, and like, this is how this can really be, you know? And it takes bravery to do that, like, to, you know, let Terrace take a, you know, a real intense saxophone solo, you know, it's the second song, third song of a really mainstream hip-hop record, takes courage, you know?
I want to hear a little bit of my guest Kamasi Washington on Kendrick Lamar's album To Pimp a Butterfly. This song is called You. I cry myself to sleep. Everything is your fault. Falls breaking to pieces. Earthquakes on every weekend. Because you shook as soon as you knew confinement was needed. I know your secrets. Don't let me tell them to the world about this you thinking. And then time to eat about the Earl. I'm up. But I ain't as tough as you. When you started making your own records, did you already have an idea of what was going to be different and special about them? I mean, was it like something that you'd been saving up?
Yes. I mean, for me, when I started playing with Snoop, all of a sudden, you know, around that time period of my life, I started really gigging a lot. And I was, it was, I had a probably 60% was non-jazz, 40% of what I was doing was jazz. And we came back from a long Snoop tour, we were out for 2 months or something like that. And I was like, man, I have to start making my own music, because I'm spending so much of my time making music for other people. I don't want to get lost. I don't want to lose myself. I didn't get into music for blue-collar reasons. Like, I really want to make great music. And so it's cool to make music for other people. But one, to not fall in the pitfall of trying to force in my own musical ideas into whatever you're doing, you know, so I can be a good professional musician and that, I'm going to give you what you want. I need to have my own outlet, you know. And so, now it's around the time that people really started, the home studio became a real possibility. And so it was, at first, I have to just maintain myself because I'm, you know, a bit in demand. And, I was playing with Snoop. I was playing with Lauryn Hill. I was playing with Rafael Sadiq. I was playing with Stanley Clark and Shaka Khan and Gerald Wilson and all these different people. And it was I was a regular at LAX. You know, it was I just had to, have an outlet to be able to maintain, who I am. That's, I make some music that is exactly the way that I want to do it. And that way, it was twofold. One, I can maintain myself and still, be able to, because I feel like if you're going to make some music for someone else, you got to make it for them and give them what they want and not try to, you know, push their hand one way or the other, you know. So it started off as that. And then, I made a few records well, here's what I sound like now. You know, I didn't really think of them as something I was really trying to release. It was just something I wanted to make, you know. And then Lotus asked me to make a record for Brain Feeder. And that was the first time I really thought about making the record that is this is my album. This is what my contribution to music is. Not just a functionary thing that's I need to document when I'm at and have some place to be me. This is okay, now make something that you will feel is your contribution, you know? And that was the first time I had that thought. And for me then, it was I had to kind of figure out, who am I musically? Who am I? And, you know, I felt like I had the side of myself that was an instrumentalist, you know, that played saxophone. And then I had the side of myself that's a composer that made music. And so I was trying to make a record when I made the epic that really showcased both of those two sides of who I am. And then the third component was just, what do you think about the world? You know? And so that's kind of where I've been with my records, is trying to show who I am musically and who I am beyond music.
Let's hear some music from my guest Kamasi Washington's album, The Epic, from 2015. This song is called Misunderstanding. It's funny, you know, James Brown was famous for touring with two drummers. And the reason, and my mom had an old friend who used to play drums for James Brown, and he told me this once when I was a teenager, made me a big impact. He'd always tour with two drummers so he could fire one whenever he wanted. I gave him a buffer. when you did that tour, when you did the tour for the Epic, you had doubles of a lot of people in your, but you brought a big band. But... I read an interview where you said, and I thought it was really fascinating, one of the reasons, for example, that you brought two drummers was that when you're in the rhythm section of a jazz band, the expectation is so powerful that you're holding it down, essentially, that by having two drummers, you gave your drummers the opportunity to have the breathing room to express themselves. And that is such a – that struck me as such a beautiful idea. I mean, an expensive idea for you because you're the one writing the checks when your name's on the – when your name's on the billboard or whatever, but or on the marquee. But that's a really beautiful idea.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of happened on accident. I mean, basically what happened is this is the time we were all touring. Like, so the same thing that happened to me happened to all my friends. Like, we got out of high school and everybody was in demand and everybody's getting pulled in a million different directions. So we used to joke that, like, getting us all in the room together was like getting the planets to align, you know? And so I had this regular gig at this place called Fish Street Dicks. And so, you know, I would come off tour and whenever I was off tour, we would start back up playing at Fish Street Dicks. And so we were back, and we were supposed to play this one night, and the band was supposed to be Cameron, Ronald Bruner, and Thundercat. And all three of them canceled on me the day of the gig. And I gave them a hard time. I was like, you know, this is bull. Like, how you going to cancel on me day of, blah, 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 blah. Even though I knew I could find somebody, I was just giving them a hard time. And so I ended up calling Miles Mosley, Brandon Coleman, and Tony Austin. And somehow they all came together same day. You know, both sets came. And when we played, everybody thought it was going to be chaos. But what ended up happening is that it was that. Like, it freed. Someone in those positions had freedom, you know? And so, like, I felt like all those guys, all my friends and the rhythm section, probably my crew, always struggle between, like, wanting to just be creative and just be free and just make music and holding down their position in the rhythm section, you know? So, like, people like Miles, you know, he struggled, like, playing like a bass player because he wanted to almost play like a guitar / cello, you know, keyboard. Like, he wanted to take crazy solos and do all this stuff and play high and, you know, do all these things. And so did Thundercat. But when you put them both together, what would happen is they were fine being in that position for a little while, but then they'd always want to go out. But they could just kind of switch back and forth. And so all of a sudden I was getting, like, more of the creativity and more of the solid. And I was like, oh, this is kind of actually really, really dope. It was dope the very first time we did it. It was like, I was like, wow, that was really dope. And then I just kept it. And now I'm addicted to it. And it's hard to go without it. You know, the same thing happened with Cameron and Brandon. It was like, all of a sudden, you know, the keyboard player, like, you don't have to be so worried about, like, playing the chord changes because he's playing the chord changes, so I can, like, create some other kind of thing, you know. Like, Brandon could stop playing the chords and spend 2 minutes tinkering with his, you know, his Moog synthesizer and, like, create a really cool sound, you know, because there's someone else, you know. And so it added such a huge amount of creativity. But there is also the fact that, you know, drummers wise that, you know, guys are not always timely, so one of these dudes would be at the gig on time, so it takes a little bit of the stress off.
I mean, you're also a man who's not afraid of a 20-person choir, so
yeah. Oh yeah, yeah.
You don't hear that many jazz records with the budgets they've got bringing in.
yeah. I mean, it's you know, I've always been that way. I've always been the kind of person that like kind of bringing people together. You know, like, my house is always the hangout spot when we're growing up. I'm always the one that's advocating for the after party. Like, let's all go here, everybody. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I think that's part of it, too. You know? And then, you know, it's, you know, as a composer, like, the more voices you have, it's like the more freedom you have.
Well, Kamasi Washington, we're out of time, but I could talk to you about this stuff for forever. I love your music. Thank you so much for coming on Bullseye. It was great to meet you.
Oh, man, thanks for having me.
Kamasi Washington. If you haven't heard his music, go seek out more of it now. 2015's The Epic is already a classic. It's almost 3 hours long. It will not disappoint you. His latest album, Heaven and Earth, is also brilliant. It's out now. Kamasi is touring North America at the moment. He'll be playing Atlanta, Washington, D.C., Brooklyn, and more. Go to the Bullseye page at MaximumFun.org for dates and more info. Let's take a listen to one more track from Kamasi's album, The Epic. This one's called Clair de Lune. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Simon Rich is one of my favorite comedy writers in the world. He got started young, first as editor of the Harvard Lampoon, then at just 23 as a writer on Saturday Night Live. He's also written for Pixar, The New Yorker, and he's the author of now 7 books. He created the TV show Man Seeking Woman, and he just had another pilot picked up by ABC, and he is not yet 35 years old. Earlier this year, he wrote a book called Hits and Misses. It's a collection of short stories, some of his funniest work to date, and whoo, man, is he funny. We invited him to come by the Bullseye studio and read some of his favorites. This one is called New Client.
Albie Katz, founder and CEO of Bright Stars Talent, was great at signing actors. Unfortunately, he was less great at providing them with actual careers. The brightest star he'd ever managed was a dancing chimpanzee named Mr. Mo, and he hadn't worked much since the formation of PETA. The humans Albie signed hadn't fared much better. One hardworking man eked out a living as an ass double. The best the rest could hope for was to play a murdered corpse on CSI. Albie knew he was a hack, and he would have quit years ago if it hadn't been for his wife, Rose. Albie had proposed to her when they were still in high school, vowing to take care of her until the day she died. It was one of the few promises he'd kept, and he was determined not to break it. He couldn't afford full-time nursing care, but he still earned enough from his roster of corpses and asses to keep her well-fed and content. She couldn't drink wine anymore since it interfered with all her medicines, but he'd found a non-alcoholic brand at the Rite Aid, and every day he served her glass after glass on a silver-plated tray. She didn't talk much, but when he stooped down to kiss her, she closed her eyes and beamed, just like she had on their first date. Albie had just tucked her in for her afternoon nap when he heard someone knocking on the door. It started as an eager tap, but quickly intensified into a menacing thump. He didn't bother peeking through the peephole. He was 81 years old with stage 4 emphysema. Who else could it be? Death was taller than he expected, about 8'6" if you included his pointy hood.
"Are you Albie Katz?"
he intoned in an unsettling baritone. "Probably no use denying it," Albie said. "Come on in." Death followed him into the bungalow, stooping to get under the doorframe. "Can I get you a drink?" Albie asked.
"No,"
Death said. "You sure?" Albie grabbed a bottle of Rose's Rite Aid wine. "This is a great vintage, a Grand Cru from France. Happy to open it." Death held up an hourglass.
"Silence, mortal. Your time has come."
"Got it," Albie said. "Let me just say goodbye to Rose. He stepped into the bedroom and looked down at his snoring wife. He was about to kiss her forehead when an idea occurred to him. It was a long shot, sure, but what did he have to lose? He reached into the closet and found his best blazer, the good luck shark skin he always wore to meetings. Then he cracked his neck and strolled back into the living room. "Huh," he mumbled. Death glared at Albie, his red eyes burning like a pair of embers.
"What?"
"Oh, nothing," Albie said, flicking his wrist. "You probably wouldn't be interested."
"What is it, Mortal?"
growled the Reaper.
"Tell me."
"Well, I'm a talent scout," Albie said. "I represent actors, features, and TV mostly." He took out a business card and offered it up to Death. The Reaper turned it over in his giant, bony hand. "Anyway," Albie continued, "I guess I was just curious if you'd ever considered performing."
"Ha ha,"
Death said sarcastically. "I'm serious," Albie said. "There's something about you. You've got a certain quality, a presence."
"That's ridiculous,"
Death said.
"I'm an actor."
"You've never even thought about it?"
"No."
"Really?" Albie said. "I find that hard to believe. You're telling me you've never once performed in your entire life?" Death was silent for a moment. His eyes were still burning, but with slightly less intensity than before.
"I mean, I did a little theater back in high school, but that was a really long time ago."
"What kind of theater?"
"It doesn't matter. It was a long time ago. It was stupid."
"Come on," Albie begged. "I'm curious." Death shrugged his knobby shoulders.
"I guess one thing I did that didn't totally suck was this production of Macbeth."
Albie raised his bushy eyebrows. "Whoa, you did Shakespeare? What part did you play?" Death towed the carpet.
"Well, actually,"
he said,
"if you must know, I played the part of Macbeth."
Albie whacked Death in the robe. "Seriously? The lead?" Death waved his bony hands in the air.
"It's no big deal,"
he said.
"It's mostly just because no one else wanted to do it."
Albie smirked. "No one?"
"Well, I beat out a couple guys,"
Death allowed.
"But they weren't very good."
His voice lowered.
"I mean, one guy was pretty good, and he'd done a lot of plays before, and it was my first time auditioning. I got it over him, so, you know, that was cool."
He shrugged again.
"But like I said, it was a long time ago."
"Sounds like you were pretty good."
"I mean, I was all right,"
Death said.
"Like, after that play, people were definitely like, you should pursue that. Like, if you look at my yearbook, it's all, see you on Broadway, stuff like that. But what did they know? It was a long time ago. It was stupid."
"Listen," Albie said. "There's this script making the rounds right now, this Scorsese thing. He's looking for an actor who's over 8 feet tall, with a baritone voice, eyes that burn, not too experienced. I know you've got a full-time job, but I'm sure he'd be grateful if you would at least go and meet with him." A smile flashed across Death's face, which he quickly suppressed.
"I mean, I guess it might be interesting to meet with him,"
he said.
"Just so I could have, like, a funny story, you know? As a goof."
Albie nodded.
"I'm not even sure I'd even want to do it,"
Death stressed.
"Like, even if you wanted to cast me in a movie, it's not like it's my big dream to become some actor."
"Of course not," Albie said.
"I mean, I don't mean any offense to actors,"
Death clarified.
"It just seems like kind of a silly life."
"It's completely silly," Albie confirmed. "Always being hounded by the press, people asking for autographs, trying to be your buddy."
"Yeah,"
Death said.
"Yeah. Still, it might be fun just to meet with Scorsese. As a goof, you know? Just as a fun, stupid goof."
"Right," Albie said. "As a goof." He gestured at the empty hourglass. "Of course, these meetings do take a little bit of time to set up." Death hesitated.
"I guess I don't have to take you right this second."
Albie grinned and whipped out his standard Bright Stars contract. Death's hands twitched anxiously as he flipped through the official-looking pages.
"Should I change my name?"
he asked.
"Is Death too Jewish?"
"We can discuss later," Albie said. Death nodded and signed on the dotted line.
"Okay,"
he said.
"So what now? Is it like a thing where you call me when there's something?"
"Yes, I call you."
"Cool,"
Death said.
"Cool."
He started to leave but stopped in the entryway.
"One other thing I might as well tell you about is that I also kind of play a little music. Mostly guitar, but also piano and bass."
"Good to know," Albie said.
"And I took 2 years of tap,"
Death said quickly.
"Okay, I'll let you get to work. You'll call me, right? That's how it works."
"I'll call you," Albie confirmed.
"Okay,"
Death said.
"Okay."
He floated out the door and vanished in a haze of wispy smoke. Albie heard a rustling sound in the bedroom. He grabbed the Rite Aid wine, went inside, and kissed Rose softly on the cheek. "Who are you talking to, sweetie?" she asked. "I just landed a new client." "Ooh, Albie," she said, beaming. "You're the best in the biz." He poured out two glasses and they clinked them together. "I'm not bad," he said.
Simon Rich, reading the short story New Client from his book Hits and Misses. All of his books are so funny. I really cannot begin to tell you how funny Simon Rich is. If you've got a trip coming up maybe for the holidays, pick up that new one, Hits and Misses. You won't be disappointed. That's all for this week's Bullseye. Bullseye recorded at MaximumFun.org World Headquarters overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California. Here at Maximum Fun HQ, we had some high-quality Halloween costumes, including Banana, Patrick Starfish, McDonald's cashier, Ellie from Jurassic Park, and Danny, our operations associate, dressed as Kevin, Bullseye's producer. I was Giants legend Willie Mays, which I realized was a mistake when I started to walk around with my children trick-or-treating in Los Angeles. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. He had help from Casey O'Brien. Production fellows for MaximumFun.org are Jesus Ambrosio and Shayna Deloria. Our interstitial music was provided to us by DJW, a.k.a. Dan Wally. Thanks to Dan. Thanks also to the Go team for recording our theme song, Huddle Formation. They and their label Memphis Industries let us use it, and we're ever grateful to them. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows, all of them are free. You can find hundreds, almost coming up on 20 years worth. Whew. On our website at MaximumFun.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. The Outshot will be back next week. This week it was a casualty of jury service. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.